I don't have a PowerPoint tonight, so I'm going to stay down here, especially since most everybody's back a little ways. Psalm 91, I appreciate Sam reading this for us and doing a good job doing that. When you think about the essentials of life, the essential needs, if you know, what are the three basic things everybody needs? We would say food, right? That's right on the top of my list anyway. And clothing and shelter, right? Those are sort of the three basic things that everybody needs. I don't go very long without thinking about food. And we need clothes every day. And how important is shelter? Well, it's probably in the descending priority list. It'd be number three. You know, there's people that are homeless, and you can survive, you know, without having a shelter. But I wouldn't want to, right? And when I don't know how they make it when the weather gets really bad. And I don't know what they do when it's storming and when it's snowing and cold and different things like that. Shelter is important. They probably have to find shelter, even if they don't have a permanent shelter. Because people, unlike deer and other things, just aren't meant to live out in the wild with no shelter. In fact, if you ever watch one of those programs where somebody's on a deserted island or read a book about that, usually one of the first things they do is look for some fresh water. And then they start gathering up some kind of way, looking for a cave or building some kind of little thing out of branches and stuff to have a place to sleep at night. We don't like being out exposed to the elements, as we say. What comes to mind when you think of a good shelter? What kind of emotions or thoughts come to mind? I think of safety, warmth, comfort, shielding. Different kinds of shelter offer different levels of protection, right? You know, when the hurricanes are coming and the storms like that, there's certain kinds of shelters that are not dependable. Some kinds of, homes are more susceptible to damage than others. And then there's other things that are built very, very strong. We have storm shelters. We have bomb shelters. We have things that are built to withstand heavy forces, right? And probably the least of those would be some kind of flimsy thing like a tent. I remember when I was a kid, pretty young. I don't remember how old we were, but I was at my friend Kip's house. We were spending the night at his mom's house, and her house sat back off the road, like the Sprays, and you had this kind of long driveway, and we went out and we put up a tent in the front yard in front of some trees and kind of felt like we were camping, you know what I mean, but we weren't very far from the house. Well, as soon as it got good and dark, we were laying there and we were talking, but once we got quiet, we could hear something walking around, and I never did see it. It was probably a possum or, you know, who knows, a cat, something was walking around, but you could hear it, walking. Man, after a minute or two, we unzipped that door and ran as fast as we could for stronger shelter, and probably where mom was too. That probably had something to do with it. Get in there where some adult was. But we felt exposed out there in that tent. We didn't feel all that secure and safe. So tonight we're going to be thinking about shelter, and what kind of shelter do we find in God? That's the way this psalm begins. Verse 1 says, "He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will abide in the shadow of the Almighty. I will say to the Lord, my refuge and my fortress, my God in whom I trust." This fits really well with the last month's psalm. Last month we were in Psalm 90. Look back over at verse 1 of Psalm 90. That was the psalm of Moses. And Moses begins Psalm 90 by saying, "Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations." That's interesting to think of God as a dwelling place. Think of your dwelling place, your home. Well, he's saying, God, you're our home. And when you picture Moses and those Israelites out there just wandering around in the wilderness, where was their home? Moses says God was their home. God was their dwelling place. And this psalm, Psalm 91, begins in a similar thought, that if we take shelter in the Most High, that he is our dwelling place. What kind of dwelling place? A refuge. What do you think of when you think of the word refuge? It's probably not a word we use all that often, but a refuge is a place you would flee to for safety usually. It's like you want to get to home base so you have some protection. It's a place to go to get away from either some danger, whether it be weather, storms. You take refuge, find a good sturdy place to be where you're not exposed, or if you were being chased by someone or something, some enemy, you'd find refuge, take refuge somewhere. A refuge and a fortress, and surely fortress brings that idea behind, something you get behind and it's strong, maybe made out of stone, or it's something that you can't, that you'll be safe if you get in there. I remember they were telling us as we were watching the news and the hurricane was coming through Florida, they said over and over, the dorm where Jack was strong and built strong, and it was built new, and you don't really have to worry about the structure of that. It was a concrete kind of a building, and so they were in a good place in terms of that storm coming through. And that's, you know, I understand the 911 center up on the hill in town is built to be a shelter and built to withstand quite a bit because they need to be able to be in there in case of, you know, some kind of really bad weather. I want to say it could withstand a tornado passing right over it and it would still be there. They're able to communicate with people and all that kind of stuff. So there's places that are like a fortress. And that what he's saying is God is that kind of dwelling place that you get there and you are safe from whatever's going on outside, however wild and crazy it is, however dangerous it is. If you're in God, you are shielded from that. Verse 3 says, he will deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the deadly pestilence. The snare of the fowler, that's not something we would think of. Snare of the fowler. A fowler is a hunter of birds. In our day, you hunt birds with a shotgun if you hunt birds. And that's not the way they did it in the old days. They didn't hunt birds with a shotgun back in the Bible times. A lot, they hunted with a snare and with a net. And there's verses about that. Turn over to Proverbs chapter 1. We'll look at a couple of wisdom literature statements about this. We'll come back to Psalm 91, of course. But Proverbs chapter 1 says in verse 17, for in vain is a net spread in the sight of any bird, but these men, talking about the foolish, lie in wait for their own blood. They set an ambush for their own lives. The picture is they've set out an ambush. They're going to be the ones caught in it. And he says you don't spread the net out with the bird sitting there watching you. The bird's not going to come land on that net. But the image is that when there's no bird around, there's a net that's spread and the guy is somewhere nearby and he's lying in wait and he's waiting when the bird lands or walks over that. Maybe they put some bird seed or something there. When the bird gets in, all of a sudden he can do something and catch that bird in the net. And a snare is a similar thing. And I looked up, I Googled it. There's lots of designs for snares where a bird can land on this little thing and it trips it and somehow the string or whatever catches his feet and somehow he's stuck. He's caught in a snare. Little traps. You can make your own trap like that if you wanted to catch a bird. I don't know why you'd want to catch a bird that way. But I guess it would have to be the right kind of bird. I'd catch a sparrow or something, I guess, if it was my luck. It wouldn't be much good. But you can set snares for birds, and the idea is that it's something that catches them suddenly. While you're there in Proverbs, look over to Ecclesiastes chapter 9. And this is used as a picture of the uncertainty of life. Ecclesiastes 9, verse 12 says, for man does not know his time, like fish that are taken in an evil net, like birds that are caught in a snare. So the children of man are snared at an evil time when it suddenly falls upon them. Just like that bird, he lands and he doesn't know that he's landing on a trap. And if he knew it, he wouldn't go there. That's why I said, in vain is the net spread in the sight of any bird. Well, if the bird saw you spread the net, he's not going to go on it. But if you don't know it's there and the bird just lands, he's caught. And the writer here is saying that's the way it is with people too, right? Sometimes your day comes and you don't see it coming. You don't know that was coming. If you knew, maybe you would do something differently, but suddenly your life is over. And that it can happen that way to people, and that's the warning there. Now, back in our psalm, he is saying that if we take refuge in the Lord, he will deliver us from the snare of the fowler and from the deadly pestilence. Of course, that pestilence is like a plague or disease. It's not, you know, we've done a lot, we've come a long ways in terms of pestilence. Used to be something like that, a plague would take hold and wipe out a huge chunk of the population. But we're still susceptible to disease, of course. But he's saying that those who take shelter in the Lord will be delivered from that. Verse 4 says, he will cover you with his pinions. That's a word for wings. Under his wings you will find refuge. His faithfulness is a shield and a buckler. So the idea is that these are words of comfort. When we take shelter in God, he hovers over us in his pinions, those long feathers that you fly with, that he's going to cover you with those. And isn't that a beautiful thought? of taking shelter in God. And you might remember that Jesus said this about Jerusalem. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often I would have gathered you together as a hen gathers her chicks, but you would not. But he had that desire and that longing to shield them, protect them, cover them, to be that mothering sort of protective, almost sacrificing yourself image of a hen huddling over her chicks to put herself in harm's way but keep them safe. And Jesus had that desire for his people, but they didn't want anything to do with it. And that shows in this psalm is talking about someone who takes refuge in God. Someone who is seeking God and wants to be, in his presence. They're going to find in God this kind of comforting shelter and shield from danger. In fact, it says his faithfulness is a shield and a buckler. And I thought, that's a funny word, a buckler. But a buckler, if you Google it, is like a small shield that you would carry on one hand. So if you're fighting with a sword, you've got a sword over here and you've got this kind of a smaller shield. And so you can imagine that you're using, when the other guy's swinging a sword at you, you block the blow with that one. And then you're fighting with his hand and you're blocking his blows. But the buckler is something that shields against the enemy's weapons. It might be something he throws at you, or it might be a sword. And you can use that buckler to block that blow so it doesn't hurt you. And he's saying that God is our shield and buckler. Verse 5, you will not fear the terror of the night. That was what happened to us in the tent that night. That was the terror of the night. It's the unknown. And isn't it funny how even in your own house, familiar things cast weird shadows and noises are amplified as you lay there in bed and you can hear stuff. And it's like something about the nighttime, right? Because you feel vulnerable. But he says, you will not fear the terror of the night, nor the arrow that flies by day, nor the pestilence that stalks in darkness, nor the destruction that wastes at noonday. These are all things that would be frightening. Imagine if you're fighting in a battle back then, and the other side has their arrows, and they're just launching them in the air. I'm sure you'd never see it coming. You'd be walking along, and whoop, you'd be, it's just a matter of luck, right? The arrows are flying through the air. You can't possibly look up and jump out of the way. It would just be if you were in the wrong place at the wrong time or not. And he said, but you're not going to be afraid of that if God's going to take away the fear of those things. Verse 7, 1,000 may fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand, but it will not come near you. You will only look with your eyes and see the recompense of the wicked. Because you've made the Lord your dwelling place, the Most High who is my refuge, no evil shall be allowed to befall you, no plague shall come near your tent. Now, this illustration is going to be silly to some of you, but if you're my age or so, you grew up playing on video games. And if you're older, you might have watched your kids or grandkids play these video games. But a whole lot of them in the video game, like even the oldest ones like Mario. Now we're getting ancient video games, right? I know there were some before that. I had Pong and those other things, too, on the Atari. But about the time Nintendo came out and you could play Mario, there, every now and then in the game, you'll have some kind of invincibility power you can get if you find the right thing. And all of a sudden, your little man is invincible. He's flashing, or he's got some kind of bubble around him. And for a moment of time, you can do whatever you like because the enemy can't touch you. So you can just run through people, and the things that would normally hurt you can't hurt you anymore because usually it fades away after a little bit. But for a little while, you're untouchable, right? So you can just run with wild abandon. And nothing can hurt you because you've got this invincibility thing going on for just a little bit. And that's pretty common in those games. But that's almost what he's describing here, that you're running into battle and people are just falling all around. 10,000 people falling beside you, but not you. You're still charging ahead and everybody around you is falling and you're still going strong because God is protecting you. And in fact, it says plainly in verse 10, no evil shall be allowed to befall you. So if this protective bubble is around us, does that mean then that nothing bad will happen to someone who puts their faith in God? Isn't that an interesting question? That leads right into the next two verses that should ring a bell. For he will command his angels concerning you to guard you in all your ways. On their hands they will bear you up lest you strike your foot against a stone. Do you know who quoted that? The devil quoted that in Matthew chapter 4. Turn with me there to Matthew chapter 4. As far as I know, this is the only scripture that we have a record of Satan quoting. But Satan quotes from the psalm that we're studying tonight. He quotes from Psalm 91 as part of tempting Jesus in Matthew chapter 4, verse 5. This is the second temptation in Matthew's account. Jesus has already said that he will not turn the stones to bread. Then the devil took him, verse 5, to the holy city and set him on the pinnacle of the temple, which was a big building. So he's way up high. And he said to him, "If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you, and on their hands they will bear you up, lest you strike your foot against a stone." Now, usually, we would think that Satan's going to twist things around, right? You know, in the garden, he twisted things around what God said. He didn't say it right to Eve. He said, he missed it up, you know, because you can't eat of any of the trees. And she said, no, we can eat of all of them except for one. And he said, you will not surely die when God. But here he does a pretty good job of quoting Psalm 91. I don't see any mistake in his quotation of it. What he is twisting around is the meaning of the psalm. So what he's suggesting to Jesus is, since you're the Son of God, why don't you prove it by doing this trust fall? Have you guys seen a trust fall, that kind of exercise you do? It's a thing where you get a friend or somebody to stand behind you, and you know they're there, and you just fall like this, and they catch you. Well, or maybe you put your hands out because they're going to catch you. So you stand like this, and you just fall back, and you have to trust they're not just going to let you flop on the floor, right? And so it's a trust fall. It's a game or something you can do with people to trust. But Satan's challenging Jesus to do a trust fall. He's saying, you really believe God, then I'm going to take you up here, and we're standing on top of this temple, and you just fall off and then trust. If you're the Son of God, you'll trust him. Because, Satan says, look what he promises in Psalm 91, that he will send his angels to catch you. And he's not even going to let you stub your toe. And so, is that really what Psalm 91 is saying? Jesus responds in verse 7, again, it is written, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test. Jesus doesn't even answer Satan's use of this psalm. Jesus doesn't say, you misunderstood the psalm. He doesn't say any of that. He just says, you're not allowed, we don't put God to the test. We're not going to, the point is, God tests us. We don't test God. It's not our place to say, okay, God, I'm going to put you to the test. Jesus says that's not the way it works. And so that's the only answer he gives to that. But I think if we go back to the psalm and think about it, we'll realize that Satan's application of this psalm was not correct. We'll come back to that in just a moment when we get to the application part. But let's continue. It is fascinating to notice what the next verse is. And I'm sure Satan didn't understand the implications of this. The next verse, where Satan stopped quoting, the next verse, verse 13 says, you will tread on the lion and the adder, the young lion and the serpent you will trample underfoot. You know, back in Genesis, God said to Eve he said to the serpent that you will, Genesis 3:15. I'm trying to quote it and I'm not able to. Look at Genesis 3:15. After he tempted Adam and Eve and caused them to fall, God says in his cursing of the serpent, I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel. So the serpent's going to try to bite the offspring of woman, and the offspring of woman is going to stomp on his head. And most see this as a reference to Jesus' ultimate victory over the devil, the serpent of old. Well, it's interesting, in our passage today in Psalm 91, it says that the one who trusts in God, who seeks in God, will trample the serpent underfoot. And it's interesting, that just happens to be the verse after the verse that Satan's using to try to tempt Jesus to challenge God. If he understood the significance of the next verse, he might have known that he was up against a power that he isn't going to be able to conquer. Okay, let's finish up the psalm and then make some applications. So 14, because this is now God speaking, it kind of shifts to God talking. Because he holds fast to me in love, I will deliver him. I will protect him because he knows my name. When he calls to me, I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will rescue him and honor him. With long life, I will satisfy him and show him my salvation. Okay, so the psalm is a psalm of comfort, of reassurance, that we can take refuge in God and he will shelter us and shield us and protect us. That's the message of the psalm, right? Now, let's think about this question about suffering. Does that mean then that for those who put their faith in God, their life will be pain and trouble free? Well, we know that can't be the case. Even that verse that he will give his angels charge concerning you, that they will bear you up lest you dash your foot on a stone. I mean, if I understand what it's saying is you're not going to stub your toe on a rock because the angels will be there to lift you up, right? So even if you're walking along the path, you're never going to even trip over anything or stump your foot, or basically nothing's going to hurt you because you put your trust in God. And Satan uses that to challenge Jesus to put that to the test by doing this trust fall off the temple. And clearly he's misunderstanding that. But let's look at a couple of verses to clear up a thing or two. 2 Timothy chapter 2. And there's so many that say the same thing. I just picked one. But 2 Timothy chapter 2. In verse 3, Paul is writing to Timothy here. And notice what he says to him. Share in suffering as a good soldier of Christ Jesus. And Peter would even say to us that Jesus left us an example of suffering, that we walk in his footsteps. Suffering is part of being a Christian. Jesus suffered, and he was the ultimate faithful person, right? He was the only perfect person, and yet did he have to suffer? Of course he had to suffer. So that's not what the psalm is saying. The psalm is not saying that if you trust in God, nothing painful, no sickness, no disease, no danger, no death will ever, if that was true, then everybody who ever trusted in God would still be alive and could just walk around through life because they could just walk across a busy highway and the cars would miss them and they could just do whatever they want because they're sort of like invincible. That's not what the psalm is saying. What is the psalm saying then? The psalm is saying that God will deliver you from all these dangers. Look at 2 Corinthians 4. I think this is a good example of how this works. 2 Corinthians 4. And we'll look at verses 8 through 10. Here Paul is talking about the trials and suffering that he endured as an apostle. He says, beginning verse 8, we are afflicted. That's pain, by the way. We're afflicted in every way, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not driven to despair. Persecuted, look at verse 9, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. Always carrying in the body the death of Jesus, so the life of Jesus may be manifested also in our bodies. What he knew was that even though the enemy's throwing everything he's got at us, it isn't going to destroy us or crush us because God is going to deliver us. So even though we are suffering, God is going to shield us and protect us and deliver us from those things. Now look with me to Hebrews chapter 13. Hebrews 13, verses 5 and 6. Keep your life free from the love of money and be content with what you have. For he has said, I will never leave you or forsake you. So we can confidently say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? This is the point, I believe, that if you trust in God, it takes away the fear of all the bad things in the world because we know that God is going to be with us. He's not going to forsake us. Therefore, if that's true, then what can man do to me? What can anybody do to you? If God holds you in his hand and you have your salvation locked in, your hope is strong, and nobody can take that away from you, then you are, in a sense, invisible, invincible. Romans chapter 8, probably the most familiar passage along these lines. This is almost exactly what Paul says at the end of Romans 8 when he's basically saying, look, what can hurt you? Verse 35, who can separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or sword? As it is written, for your sake we're being killed all day long. We're regarded as sheep to be slaughtered. No, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. And that familiar passage, he goes on to say, nothing can separate us from the love of God. So if that's true, then it is this idea of invincibility, isn't it? Which of these things can take away the love of God? Which of these things can take away your salvation? Which of these things can take away your hope? Nothing out there. There's nothing in the whole world that's so powerful that it can take away your salvation or your hope, your joy and peace in God. And if that's the case, then we have that kind of protection that the enemy can't touch you, that even though everybody around you falls, you just keep on walking through because God is shielding you and God is protecting you. Turn with me to Hebrews chapter 1. One last thing to consider, Hebrews chapter 1. You remember in that psalm, even the part that Satan quoted, it said he will give his angels charge concerning you. Does that still apply? Look at what Hebrews 1 says. Hebrews 1, talking about angels, verse 14. Are they not all ministering spirits sent out to serve for the sake of those who are to inherit salvation? Are angels still sent out to serve for the sake of those? I think they're saying yes, they are. So even in Psalm 91, we said he'll give his angels charge concerning you. Now, what are those angels doing? I can't explain all that. But think about who all's on your side and who all's on my side. If you take shelter in God, if you seek him by faith, you have God the Father, the creator of the universe, the Son, who is there interceding on your behalf, the Spirit, who is giving you strength and comfort and helping your prayers. Now you've got the angels who've been sent to make sure that you're all right, to help you and work with you. You've got all this host of power that is so powerful that there really isn't any enemy out there that has a chance. As long as you have faith in God, that you can take shelter in him like this fortress that the tornadoes can roar right overhead. The enemy can shoot bombs and do whatever they want to do, but you're safe because you've been shielded by God. That's the security that we have when we put our trust in God, we put our faith in him. It does not mean that you'll never suffer. Jesus suffered. But what it means is that if you have faith in God, God will deliver you from all that, and that suffering will not crush you and destroy you, that in the end, you're still going to be safe and saved. What a wonderful thought to have such a fortress that we can take refuge in. Perhaps there's someone here tonight who needs to make your life right in some way. We don't want to close the evening without offering the invitation. We do that every time we come together, just in case there's somebody that needs to do something. If we can pray for you, if there's any way we can help you, let us know as we stand and sing.